The roots of our attachment to the places we love go deep, often all the way back to childhood. British writer Adam Nicholson grew up in one of the most beautiful places in England, Sissinghurst Castle, home of the celebrated garden created by his grandmother, the poet Vida Sackville-West. The garden was originally part of a working farm, a place with orchards and dairy barns and wheat fields. But when he came back as an adult, the garden had become a tourist attraction and the farm had disappeared. To Nicholson's eye, the meaning of the place was gone. So he set about restoring it. He tells the story in a book called Sissinghurst, An Unfinished History. He told Anne Strangechamps it was a magical place to grow up.
It was completely magical. I mean, I can't think that any childhood could have been more blessed in its physical surroundings than mine. This lovely, ruined Elizabethan house with an intensely beautiful garden, and then around it, about 500 acres of wood and stream and field. And my father, I think very consciously, led me out into it and took me on walks and bicycle rides slightly further afield, you know, to see kind of old ruined castles and medieval houses and beautiful hay meadows. And it was just, it was like another parent in a way. It was like a kind of third parent, another mother, the matrix of a life.
Sissinghurst is, well, it's one of the world's legendary gardens with a potent history. How aware of that were you when you were a child?
Well, my father is a fantastic, he's dead now, he probably still is, a fantastic mythomane was the word I always used to fling at him when I was a teenager, you know, just endless stories. And so he definitely soaked us in the mythology or our family mythology of his mother, Vita Sackville-West, as she should have been the heir of a much greater house in Kent Knoll, but had been disinherited from that because she was a girl and it went to her remote male relations. And so she had come to Sissinghurst in pain, almost, looking for somewhere to assuage the loss of Knoll. And so this place was like a substitute Knoll over which she presided as the great Chatelaine, rather domineering, famously seductive, endless lovely girls coming to have love affairs with her there.
Yeah, including Virginia Woolf.
Including Virginia Woolf, including, amazingly, her own sister-in-law. Her husband's sister was her lover for nearly 10 years at Sissinghurst. It was a very, very different world from the world we inhabit now, and I'm sure that the social police would not really approve of it today. But so we were, you know, soaked in it. Like, I always think of it like a sort of rum bar bar, just absolutely drenched in this set of family myths, which were quite selective. My father would always describe Vita as this very distant and very removed person who was always up in her lonely tower writing sonnets all night long. I don't think that is really true. She was actually much more engaged with the world around her than that.
Well, she obviously came out of the tower long enough to create this world-famous garden. I mean, just one little tiny piece of it, the Sissinghurst White Garden, is one of the most famous in the world.
She did, and it is intensely beautiful place. And I think the reason it's beautiful is that it's all about her loss, I think, that somehow Sissinghurst, with these crumbling buildings and walls, is made good by this very transient thing, a garden. It's not like someone who builds a great monumental palace. If you make a great garden, you make something that has its own decline and almost failure built into it. And Sissinghurst has a great deal of sort of beautiful sadness about it like that.
Hmm. Well, speaking of beautiful sadness, when you moved back to Sissinghurst as an adult, it was near the end of your father's life, and the place was very different. How did it strike you when you came back?
Yes, I'd obviously gone off and lived and married and had children elsewhere and lived abroad and lived in London and so on. So when we came back in 2004, and he was deep into his 80s and very ill and was in fact dying that year, I was very suddenly struck how in the intervening 30 years Sissinghurst had changed. I always accused the National Trust, well, I should explain about that, that the National Trust became the owners of the garden when my father was unable to pay the inheritance tax due on his mother's death. And so the only way he could keep Sissinghurst was to give it to the Treasury, who then gave it to the National Trust, and he made the condition that we could continue to live there as tenants. So it now belongs to this land charity, and we are its tenants forever. Anyway, Sissinghurst had become, well, I always said to them, it had become a Titian with a car park.
It had become a museum.
Well, or certainly a sort of commodity. And the farm had lost everything that I remembered. It had lost its hop gardens, its dairy herd, its sheep, its pigs, its chickens, its orchards, many of its hedges. Even it had lost its farmer. So there was none of the farm buildings were being used for farm purposes. They were all now shops and restaurants and visitor management service centres.
It wasn't just about aesthetics, though. There's also, for you, an ethical aspect to wanting to restore the working farm part of Sissinghurst, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I thought, you know, when my father, I was there with my father when he was dying, I thought, how can one get some of that feeling back into this? How can we step beyond just the sense that you're selling something beautiful here? And I realised one day, I remember very clearly the moment I thought of this, that the answer, mysteriously, was to grow lunch for the visitors. That 150,000 people a year, some 120,000 of them eat in the restaurant there. All the food that was being served in the restaurant was arriving in vans from elsewhere. And all the produce of the farm at the same time, they were growing oilseed rape and cheap wheat, soft wheat, was going off to be shipped out of the country entirely. In fact, most of it was going to Dubai and then to Asia, mainly for chapatis, apparently. Anyway, I thought that if only one could grow lunch, that one could make the landscape good again.
It's a wonderful vision, but the National Trust did not necessarily respond very well at first.
No, they didn't.
Didn't the chair of the National Trust at one point accuse you of acting like a combination of an 18th century squire and a hippie?
A hippie squire, yeah. Well, from what we were saying earlier, it's probably true. I am a hippie squire. But the money was the crunch. It, as always, you know, in government or commerce, or I mean, or in the end, you know, if you can't get the money right, you can't get the story right. And in the end, the argument I made was that the more that you genuinely grow the food that you sell in the restaurant, in other words, the more you apparently incur incredibly steep costs of doing things on very small scale and so on, the more people will want to come and buy it. You actually sell authenticity. And there was, as you can imagine, quite a few raised eyebrows at that idea, because that is not straight-up commercial thinking. But I persuaded them to do an experiment, that for 5 years we would do this. They agreed. And last year, the usual 150,000 visitors went up to 195,000 as a result. And so a good third of the cost of doing this was recovered in the first year of increased income. And I, you know, slapped that down in front of the hippies, hippie squire.
So you were able to make it financially viable. But how did the staff at Sissinghurst react when you began reviving the working farm, because they had a stake also in presenting Sissinghurst as it had been presented for 30, 40 years.
Yes, that's right. It's a very interesting thing. People were and are deeply connected to Sissinghurst and felt offended that I should stroll in and say, oh, no, 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 you're doing this all wrong. And they were very hostile. People did come up to me in the early days and say, you know, you really think you're the lord of the manor now, Adam, don't you? And then would say, well, I can tell you something, you're not, and turn on their heel. Or there was a great moment, one of the gardeners came up to me and said, that's us moving in, my wife and I and our children are chaotic and messy people, and saying that us moving in was like white trash coming to live at Sissinghurst and so on. So I realised after a while that patience and understanding that people do have a claim on the place where they work, of course they do, that was the root. And very, very slowly and gradually, people came round to the idea that I wasn't wanting to destroy what they loved, but to enhance it. And in fact, now, at the moment, it feels fantastic at Sissinghurst, better than I can ever remember, of people feeling energised and loving the, you know, beef cattle that are there and the new sheep and all the new hedges and woods and hay meadows and stuff we put in. I mean, there's a lot that's happened.
You were talking earlier about the tension between aesthetics and ethics, and what you've done with Sissinghurst, you know, is partly about functionality, but also very much about beauty. I think you write at some point in the book that the garden as a purely aesthetic construct isn't as beautiful to you as a garden that's also part of a functioning landscape. Why is that?
Well, I think I also talk in the book about something I call the honourable landscape. It's a slightly unsatisfactory phrase because it sounds so out of date. But, you know, the key element of this is about the connections between different dimensions of life. That if you think about growing and eating food and working the land and looking after wild creatures and wildflowers and so on, and a sense of beauty and a sense of history and a sense of responsibility to the people who come to see what you're doing. If you can actually make the connections between those things alive, then that is an undeniably and unapproachably beautiful thing.
You know, I'm thinking about the larger application of what you've done with Sissinghurst. And I'm thinking that some of the questions you were asking yourself would resonate for many people today. You know, this issue of how to reconnect, because we all lived through, in the latter half of the 20th century, modernization and a kind of disconnection from our old ties to the land. And I think many people now feel the kind of loss or hunger you did. How do you reconnect to the deeper meaning of a place?
Well, I think I entirely agree with you, and that's why I wrote the book, because I think this is emblematic of a nearly universal situation. That's why I put so much history in this book, that actually people in this little tiny place in the south of England have been at least since 500 AD, been concerned with cyclicality, with the way in which things come back and return, and the way in which what you do now will undoubtedly have repercussions tomorrow and next year. And the great error of the late 20th century is to have abandoned cyclicality for linearity, for thinking, I'll bulldoze this and then we're in clover for the rest of our lives. And everything in the world at the moment is saying to us, think of the cycle.
Adam Nicholson talking with Anne Strainchamps. His book is called Sissinghurst, An Unfinished History.